This is Ann Arbor Stories. I'm Rich Reddy. This episode is ultimately about a football game, but it's not really about a football game. It's about hippies, drugs, and rock and roll. Stick with it, people who use the term sports ball. You'll enjoy this one. The University of Michigan and Michigan State, then called Michigan Agricultural College, first slammed into each other on the football field on October 12, 1898. Played in Ann Arbor at Regents Field, where Ferry Field is today, Michigan shut the Aggies out 39-0 in a game that the Detroit Free Press called, quote, essentially a practice. The teams rematched in 1902, a 119-0 shellacking by the Wolverines, then met for a third time in 1907, where Michigan continued the shutout streak with a 46-0 drubbing. Since that game in 1907, the University of Michigan and the school that would eventually be known as Michigan State would meet every single year on some football field in Michigan. Through two world wars and every event in between, nothing stopped the U of M-MSU rivalry. That is, until 1970, when a former sports editor at the Michigan Daily filed suit in Washtenaw County Circuit Court to stop the Wolverines and Spartans from playing. Dissolve to Ann Arbor. The summer of 1970. The hippie movement in America's youth counterculture scene isn't what it was during the Summer of Love in 1967. Wasn't what it was the Summer of Woodstock in 1969. Nixon's in the White House, and the Vietnam draft has started. An 18-year-old is stabbed to death 20 feet from Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones at a concert in Altamont, and the public is learning all the grisly details of the Manson family murders. In 1970, a lot of people weren't thinking peace and love when they heard the word hippie. They thought sex, drugs, and disarray. On August 7th, 1970, Michigan experienced its own version of Woodstock. The three-day festival was packed with more than 200,000 hippies, burnouts, wastoids, and pinkos, who swarmed tiny Leoni Township for the Goose Lake International Music Festival. Promoter Richard Songer bought 350 acres of farmland in Goose Lake Park, a quiet corner of Jackson County, to create a permanent outdoor music arena with strong fences, restrooms, showers, kitchens, and all the infrastructure that was sorely lacking at Woodstock. When Songer officially proposed the Goose Lake International Music Festival, townsfolk freaked out. More than 400,000 people descended on Woodstock the summer before. Everyone had seen the pictures, video on the news, traffic jams, rain, mud, hippies, nudity, drugs, hippies, free love, hippies, hippies, hippies. The concert was proposed in March, and the Goose Lake Property Owners Association dragged Songer into court that spring, trying to block the August festival. The courts heard arguments about zoning laws and how the festival would pollute the area with, quote, an invasion of hippies or gypsies or whatever. Songer was forced to move ahead with his plans, hoping for a positive outcome. He cleared land for parking and camping, built an amphitheater called the Goose Nest. He ringed the entire area with 12-foot-tall chain-link fence topped with three rows of barbed wire. Songer also started booking acts. Joe Walsh, Jethro Tull in Chicago, along with homegrown acts like MC5, The Stooges, and Mitch Ryder. Songer won the first round in court, but the Jackson County prosecutor tried one last-ditch effort to stop the festival, filing for an immediate restraining order on the grounds that the gathering would be too big, too crazy, and too lewd for local law enforcement to handle. The request was denied. Festival goers trickled into the area that day before the event, pitching tents in the campground, making use of the kitchen facilities, and buying stuff from the vendors. Kids completing pilgrimages from coast to coast. Songer hired 400 security guards, including a number of White Panther Party members, to work the gates and guard the fences against intruders. The plan to keep non-paying festival goers out didn't work very well. Guards at the perimeter were bribed to let people slip through holes in the fence, and when gate receipts were counted, Songer estimated 45,000 of the 200,000 plus in attendance actually paid to get in. Songer didn't seem to mind. The weather was great, the band's amazing, and the atmosphere was peace, love, and happiness. Also, casual nudity and lots of open drug use. Police waited for the worst just outside the fence, fearing their presence inside the property would spark a riot. Residents in the surrounding Goose Lake area were spooked. Many sent their women and children to stay out of town with relatives, standing watch on their porches with loaded rifles and shotguns to protect their homes against potential hippie mobs. In the end, not a single act of violence was reported during the three-day festival. Authorities did stop and search many of the festivalgoers as they left, making 160 drug-related arrests. Meanwhile, 32 miles west, a straight shot on I-94, Ann Arbor was having its own rock and roll-related issues. The 60s didn't sit well with a lot of Michigan communities, not just those in the middle of nowhere. In 1967, local psychedelic band The Seventh Seal played a show on Belle Isle in Detroit, which climaxed in what they called a love-in. The unrecorded number of participants were whipped into such a frenzy by the music of The Seventh Seal that they rioted. At least that's what authorities reported. Concertgoers said the trouble started when Detroit police started forcibly clearing Belle Isle and things got out of hand. Just 3 years before the Goose Lake Festival, the headline, "Local Group Denies Playing Riot-Causing Festival," appeared in 30-point type in the Ann Arbor News. The Seventh Seal kept playing their mind-altering music throughout Ann Arbor, oftentimes as part of a series of afternoon Sunday rock concerts held in parks throughout the city, West Park, Gallup, and Huron Flatlands. They drew crowds of all sorts, wearing bright orange saris, dungarees, togas, bare feet, sleeveless black leather jackets, bells on their ankles and rings in their noses. Hippies of all class and phylum. These Sunday rock concerts were a formal thing in 1970. The city was worried about these crowd-causing love-ins, riots, and noise, but most of the concerts went off without a hitch. Maybe they left the lingering stench of patchouli or featured some minor drug use. Ann Arbor City Council was well acquainted with the plots and plans in Goose Lake, keeping an eye on court proceedings to block Michigan's Woodstock. 5 days before the start of the Goose Lake Festival, the situation was inflamed. At a Sunday afternoon rock concert in Gallup Park on August 2nd, 20-year-old David Lee Hunter shot 21-year-old Ipsy Motorcycle Club member Richard Morris after the two got into an altercation. Hunter was arrested, Morris severely wounded, and the anti-rock and rollers in Ann Arbor shook their heads and mouthed their "I told you so's." The Ann Arbor Blues Festival was planned for that Friday, and City Council made no attempt to curb those festivities. But they did keep one eye on Goose Lake and the other eye on the next Sunday's rock concert scheduled for August 16th at Huron Flatlands, 1 week after Michigan's Woodstock would wrap up. City Council, particularly 5th Ward Councilman Lloyd Fairbanks, feared that holdovers from the Goose Lake Festival would linger in the area and come to Ann Arbor and attend the city rock concert a week away. Fairbanks urged City Council not to allow the August 16th concert to continue until assurances were made that the Goose Lake hippies' burnouts and wasteoids had indeed dispersed. The concert was eventually allowed to continue, but City Council kept a close watch on rock and roll in their town. Fallout from Goose Lake didn't just affect Ann Arbor. It came back to bite Songer as well. He'd planned a smaller 3-day rock festival at his Goose Lake venue for Labor Day weekend, starting Sunday, September 6th. The Thursday before the rock concert, Jackson County Circuit Judge John C. Dalton ruled in favor of a petition asking that the park be closed indefinitely to all rock concerts that post, quote, "a public and common nuisance." Songer was upset, but took the blow in stride, instead holding a political rally at Goose Lake to celebrate a resolution passed in the Michigan House and Senate, allowing 18-year-olds to vote. 10,000 kids, mostly from out of state, streamed into the Goose Lake area only to be turned away at the gates after learning that the festival had been canceled. Many relocated to Portage State Lake Park, about 7 miles away, and made the best of the Labor Day weekend. But very few attended that Sunday rally. Estimates put the crowd at less than 1,000. Police made one drug-related arrest. Fade to black. Cue the Michigan Marching Band. The narrator begins. So what the heck does any of this have to do with Michigan football, Michigan State football, or their, at the time, 57-year-old gridiron rivalry? Legal precedent is a funny thing. And when wielded by a former Michigan Daily sports editor, turned janitor, turned union steward, turned counterculture sympathizer, it can threaten an American institution. An American institution like a college football rivalry game. Joel Block filed suit in Washtenaw County Circuit Court, attempting to win a restraining order against the sold-out October 17th Michigan-Michigan State game at the Big House. In addition to the suit, Block requested that Michigan Stadium be permanently closed as a site for future football games. Block cited the precedent set in the cancellation of the second Goose Lake Rock Festival as grounds for the suit. Block even employed the same language used against Goose Lake. Quote, "I am not against football, but I am for equal law enforcement. If the law applies to rock festivals, it should also apply to football games." Block obtained affidavits from 10 people who attended an October Michigan home game against Texas A&M, in which eyewitnesses reported marijuana joints being smoked and passed openly, illegal consumption of alcoholic beverages given to minors, thievery in full view of police, flags and banners symbolizing revolution against the American government, an attack on a popcorn vendor, public swearing and profanity, inadequate and overcrowded restroom facilities, traffic jams of a dangerous nature. A hearing was set for Friday before Saturday's kickoff, at which point it was expected that representatives from the University of Michigan would present evidence showing why the game should be played. Ann Arbor Police Chief Walter Krasny didn't dispute Block's game day claims. Krasny said his men were averaging 3 arrests per game for drunk and disorderly, but that, quote, "Drunkenness in the stadium usually fluctuates with the weather." Krasny did say things were better than in the old days. He credited the near extinction of excursion trains for the decline in the number of rowdy drunks in the stadium. In past years, trains packed with football fans from distant cities would pull into Ann Arbor and disgorge hundreds of liquored-up partisans right at the tracks near the stadium. Fights inside and outside the stadium were commonplace. Krasny admitted that game drunks, as he called them, were left alone in favor of those who needed real medical attention or mediation. People suffering from heat stroke or illnesses or arguments that needed cooler heads. Block's suit was ridiculous, right? Wasn't it? Legal precedent is a funny thing. Judge Ross W. Campbell heard the case. U of M lawyers called the suit patently frivolous and said that nothing would be a greater absurdity than to grant this injunction. Block's lawyers stuck to their guns. The verdict was delivered less than 24 hours before the scheduled kickoff. You didn't really think they would cancel the game, did you? The judge ruled against the suit, allowing the game to go on as scheduled. No irreparable harm would be done to the public when the two teams met on the field. The game went off without a hitch, better than could have been hoped for. Under perfect weather conditions, Michigan cruised to a 34-20 win over the Spartans, while police made a single arrest for drunk and disorderly. Traffic went smoothly, people were nice, and none of the expected protests or demonstrations materialized. The Wolverines went on to win the first 9 games that season before losing to Ohio State and Columbus. The Spartans only won 4 games that year and wouldn't beat the Wolverines until 1978. Since that game in 1970, Michigan and Michigan State have met on the football field every single year since. Through the Falkland Islands War, the Gulf War, my birthday, Brian's birthday, nothing has stopped the U of M-MSU rivalry. The Sportos won, the hippies lost, and really, what's more American than that? Ann Arbor Stories is presented by Rumble Pack Media in partnership with the Ann Arbor District Library. This episode was written and read by me, Rich Reddy, with sound and audio engineering by Brian Peters. If you haven't rated us on iTunes, we'd love the stars. Rating podcasts helps other people discover this and hopefully fall in love with Ann Arbor Stories. Thanks for your support. Also, thanks to the AADL and their archive staff, who day in and day out digitize old newspaper clippings and photos from Ann Arbor's past. Spend some time at oldnews.aadl.org and see what they've been up to. Also, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Ann Arbor Stories, or email us at annarborstories@gmail.com, ask us questions about Ann Arbor's past, or tell us how we've been doing. Thanks for listening.